Good morning, everybody. Glad to see you here. I'm Dave Buckingham. I'm the city manager for the city of Morro Bay. And sitting next to me is Mike Nunley, our program manager, for the water reclamation facility program. And then Bruce Gibson, the manager of our existing and future wastewater treatment plant and water reclamation facility. And John Fox, who is one of our city attorneys. So thank you so much for being here, both those who are in the room and those who are watching on TV, either live or perhaps on YouTube, sort of tape delayed. And this is a continued part of the city's outreach on the water reclamation facility, the construction of our new water reclamation facility, which we are on a schedule and intend to have completed phase one in 5 years, and with the phase two water reclamation component, hopefully within 2 years after that. So doing public outreach and public listening is crucial as far from the city's perspective. Sometimes some think of public outreach as just talking to the community. That is not what we're interested in doing today. We're interested in hearing from the community and, in fact, having a conversation with the community, and we will continue to do that as we go through this project. So, and that's sort of a lead-in to the kind of meeting this is. You'll notice that this is not an official council meeting. It's not a Brown Act meeting. We have council members who are attending both this morning and this afternoon. But we intend to run this more as a good exchange of information and sort of give and take with the members of the public that are here. So I'm sort of going to do an introduction, which I'm doing now, and I'll turn over to Mike to do a presentation that will be about 20, 25 minutes, and then we're going to open up the podium here for I won't describe it as public comment. Let's call it public conversation this morning. So what we don't intend to do is have 15 people come and say something and then go sit down. We'll invite you to come to the podium and ask a question, and we'll answer it, and ask a follow-up question, and we'll try to answer that. And we will, of course, in order to make sure everybody gets a chance to be heard, at some point have to move on to the next converser. But we look forward to having a more of a back and forth than you might normally see in a council meeting, where the public comment is sort of one way, and then there's a staff or council response. So this outreach session. Listening session is focused on delivery options, and then next month or in early December we'll have a follow-on seminar on technology. So I will briefly try to differentiate between the two of those, and I'm sure there'll be a little bit of back and forth, and we'll get into technology a little bit today, and perhaps do some more delivery options in November, December. But the delivery options that you're going to hear more about is about how a project like this can be delivered from the construction community, I'll say. So there's a traditional design, bid, build approach. There is a many nuances of newer approaches called design, build. And then there are also approaches such as design, build, operate, which means not only is somebody bidding to design and build the facility, but they're also committing as part of the package to operate it for a certain number of years. And then there's a fourth one, design, build, operate, finance, where not only are they perhaps going to operate the plant, but also provide the financing through that company instead of the city seeking financing, for example, through the state revolving fund. So, and it's important we have this discussion both for education and also to sort of clear up any questions in all of our minds. There are some companies out there that, for example, do design, build, operate, finance that we think of as a technology almost. But many companies will design and build for us a membrane plant. Many companies will do all sorts of different technologies. So today we're really looking at delivery options, and then in November or early December we'll have a similar outreach where we are communicating more on the technology operations, and those are the technology options. And those technology options in part are driven by what do we want to do with the water, and the guidance that we have from the council that we've heard very clearly from the community. One of our goals is to really get the highest, best use for the water. So if the regulations were in place right now, perhaps the city would want to do direct potable reuse, toilet to tap. State regulations are not in place right now. But there are other ways to reuse that water instead of dumping 1 million gallons of water a year into the ocean to reuse that water, perhaps injecting it or letting it percolate into the aquifer, into the groundwater, so we could then pull it out with our wells later and use it. Or another use would be perhaps a step lower, would be agricultural use. What we certainly have no intention of doing is dumping that water into the ocean. We're committed to building a water reclamation facility, not just a water treatment facility. So today is delivery options focus, and then 4 weeks, 6 weeks down the road, we'll have a technology-focused exchange, and we will continue this. I should also say that there's lots of individual stakeholder outreach ongoing right now. So Debbie Rudd, who's there a couple rows back, and John Rickenbach are meeting with stakeholders in one-on-one exchanges around the community, from property owners to adjacent property owners to individual residents who have great information and interest in this, to the Water Reclamation Facility Citizens Advisory Committee. And so there are several layers of public engagement and public outreach going on. So with that, I'm going to turn over to Mike for 25 minutes of presentation on the different delivery options. It's sort of education for all of us. And then we'll open up the mic and look forward to a great conversation. Yes, Chuck.
Real quick, I'm sorry. I think you said that we're dumping 1 million gallons a year.
A day.
Good, because I think you said a year.
If I said a year, no. We are. I can't believe that rolled off my tongue incorrectly. Because my elevator speech on the great decision to not rebuild an old-style plant on the oceanfront is we have a 62-year-old plant that's dumping 1 million gallons of water a day into the ocean, and if we move that and recover it, then we can all – that sits on a 26-acre oceanfront site in a tsunami zone and a partial tide zone. So we look forward to being 7 years down the road where we are recovering 1 million gallons of water a day, using that for our best use, and have a 26-acre site that we can invest in for the entire community and the entire public. That's a whole separate conversation, but what a great thing to have a huge site like that could be a visitor-serving site right there on the oceanfront. Thank you very much, Chuck, for that correction. Okay. Mike.
All right. Thanks, Dave. First, one thing I'd like to point out is a lot of communities don't really dive that deep or ask a lot of questions about project delivery. A lot of times these decisions are made by public works departments. So this is kind of a different type of presentation. A lot of material is going to be pretty dry. It's going to be given. But I think that it's really important to define what all these different terms are that have come up in the past, like what design-build means, design-build-operate, design-build-operate-finance, and then give folks a chance to ask questions. The exciting thing about Morro Bay is there's a very vocal, very involved community, and that's pretty exciting from my experience as an engineer, because you all want to know about the details and the ins and outs. So I want to thank you for your interest in this level of detail on the project, and I'm glad to try to answer any questions I can as they come up, and we'll dive in. So the goals for the workshop today, really it's education. No decisions are made today. We have a councilman here, we've got some other folks here with the Citizens Advisory Committee, but really it's education for you all. It's a chance for you all to ask questions of us. It's a chance for us to get feedback on what you think about construction approaches, what your concerns might be, if you're worried about how fairly contractors or designers are going to be selected. We really want to hear all that. We think it's really important to know what you think. So we're going to talk first about how the city builds projects now. What do they do when they build a bike path or a road or pipeline, et cetera? Why a different method is being considered for the wharf. And then other workshops that are going to come later. You're going to see many workshops, seminars, all the public wharf CAC meetings, council meetings, et cetera, over the next year plus. And the other workshops are going to cover things like architecture, the treatment approach, liquid and solids treatment, water reuse, and water quality. So those are all going to be covered later. We're strictly going to talk construction today, design and construction. So the agenda first, we always want to go back to council goals. That's critical for the project. It's where we got all the input from the public. It's what drives every decision we make on this. Every morning that we get up and spend 8 hours on the project, it's got to be toward those goals. Second, we're going to talk about conventional project design and construction, how that works, what the city kind of business as usual. Third is alternative delivery, and that's when we combine design and construction in some sort of form or fashion. We're going to compare the alternatives, and we have some recommendations on what we think makes sense. And the point is to bring these out early so that council has a chance to think about it. We can respond to questions and comments, and then later down the road, after facility master plan is done, council and the public are in a position to make a decision on delivery approach. So we're doing this early because we want folks to understand the processes and we want input. So the council goals, and I've highlighted and bolded some of the key terms. First one is minimum level of quality we're going to produce at that plan is tertiary disinfected water. That's the minimum level. We'll have to go higher to meet regulatory requirements for water quality, for groundwater recharge, and a lot of the and direct reuse for agriculture. A lot of the other options that we're looking at, we'll have to go higher than that. But the bare minimum is tertiary disinfected wastewater will be produced there. Second is we need to design to produce reclaimed wastewater for potential users. So we need to design toward potential uses. Third is to allow for on-site composting or consider on-site composting. Fourth is energy recovery, and I would add a subtext to that would be alternative energy generation. Designs that we think about contaminants of emerging concern, and a lot of folks in this community, a lot of folks in this room, I know have read a lot about pharmaceuticals and things that are just now coming on the radar of the local or the federal and state governments. So we want to design so that we think about those, dealing with those challenges in the future. Designing to allow for other possible municipal functions if they make sense. If we can get the room, and we have the room, we want to try to have as many of the community amenities there as makes sense and are affordable and as council and public want to consider. Have a new wharf operational prior to expiration of the discharge permit for the existing plant being 5 years more or less. The 5-year timeline, to me, is the biggest driver in selection for alternative delivery, and we'll talk about that. That's critical. There are other advantages to alternative delivery, too, and we'll talk about those. So the phase one, we talk about the phase one. We have two phases to the program. In a perfect world, we do everything at once. We're going to, and our goal is to push as hard and fast as we can, get as many grants and loans and well-identified reclaimed water uses or groundwater recharge locations as quickly as we can. If we can get the whole thing done in 5 years with you, we do it. The challenge is it takes a while to determine to get the recycled water end of it figured out. So where the water's going to go, getting easements for the pipelines, figuring out where the designing, constructing, and planning injection wells and that sort of thing might just take a little longer because those things require, like for example, if we're looking at ag reuse, we really need contracts with the folks who might use that water, and that negotiation process takes a while. So we want to allow more time to get those, what we call those phase two elements. favorite soft water gun. Phase one is building a functional water reclamation treatment facility. So that's tertiary disinfected wastewater being produced at the plant site.
Mike, if I can just make one comment on the
sure.
phase one versus phase two. One other factor that's really interesting right now is that the state is just starting to develop toilet-to-tap or direct potable reuse regulations. The governor is, I believe, given a 4-year timeline to have regulations in place in 4 years. If all of those regulations were in place now and we knew what they were to be able to go to direct potable reuse, and that was a community and council decision to do that, then that might be able to accelerate right. doing phase two and phase one together. But there's almost a point right now where we may not want to make some commitments on reuse until we know what those regulations look like. Because if we get 4 years down the road and we've gone 4 years down the road, we've made some decisions on phase two, and then we find out that the state's regulations don't match those decisions, that would have been a waste of money. So it's really an interesting point right now in that there is, although we want to move quickly and decisively, we also want to move wisely, and almost moving too quickly on the water reclamation point would put us ahead of the state's guidance and regulations on direct reuse, if that is indeed where we all choose we want to go.
Okay. So the phase one project elements include a lift station somewhere along the Tascadero Road where we can pick up the collection system that's already going to that location. So we need a lift station somewhere in that neighborhood. A raw sewage force main to the water reclamation facility, utility extension, things like water, power to the new site. There's power there now at the one that was top ranked that the options are for, but we may need more power than what's available now. The water reclamation facility itself, and then the wet weather or brine discharge. So those are the key elements. And so you've got the map, and you can basically see it's a linear project in a way, because you got the lift station, and you got, the reason we call it linear is because it's in a line running up the hill, about a couple miles of pipeline, and then we have the actual plant site. And this is the preferred site for the options report, was over in this neighborhood. So those are the major project elements for phase one. And according to the program schedule, this is a simplified version, but the project design, we're anticipating that's going to start in the middle of this coming 2016. We anticipate construction beginning third quarter of 2018. And then the goal currently is that we're done, closed out everything about middle of 2021. And based on the timing within which we're going to get the permit, that should meet those guidelines.
To be clear, that's closed out everything with phase one.
Yeah, that's right, with phase one. That's correct. And then we show a big arrow down at the bottom, because as we're defining phase two, we'll nail this part down. Phase two is the recycled water pipelines, recycled water storage, delivery, injection wells, whatever might come out of that master reclamation planning effort. So there are a lot of different ways to do projects, but public agencies have some of those. So what we're going to talk about today are conventional design, bid, build. That's really business as usual. It's what agencies have done for hundreds of years, literally. Collaborative project delivery alternatives, we call these collaborative because in some form or fashion, you're combining the owner, the designer, and the contractor in a different relationship than what you have with the conventional process. Construction management at risk, and we're going to talk about four specific flavors of design build. There's best value design build, progressive design build, design, build, operate, which can apply to either progressive or best value, design, build, finance, operate. We'll talk a little bit about all of these. So the big difference in all these different project delivery methods, and this is a graphic I like because it shows, you see behind, in this case, this is the city, and you see these different delivery alternatives. And I think it really shows how these collaborative project delivery approaches differ from conventional. Conventional project delivery, owner has a contract and a relationship that's separate between the designer and the contractor. Under the collaborative delivery, construction management at risk looks a little bit like that. You have a separate designer, you have a separate contractor, but the interface between these two is a whole lot closer. We'll talk about how we get there. And then these others, you got one point of responsibility for design and construction together, so it's one team. Dave gave the example of Perk Water. There's a bunch of these other design-build entities and like joint ventures between designers and contractors out there, and that's who that is. That's what we call the design builder. It's one team. It's one contractor. And then with design-build-operate, they add an operator, but that's still under their team. That's one contract for design-build and operation. So some of the benefits of that relationship in general that we just saw are cost savings, because in all those collaborative processes, you get early contractor involved, part of the model. Second is you get early cost confirmation, which is a huge deal. When engineers estimate costs, we do the best we can, but we're not contractors, we're not bidders. So you get early cost information that you can put a contract on and commit to. You get time savings because you overlap design and construction. You reduce the bid periods because you don't go out to bid for a designer and then go out to bid for a contractor after all the design documents are done. And then you reduce the design reviews. So that's a double-edged sword. We'll talk about that in a minute. But there's less design review by the owner in a lot of these cases. There is a single point of responsibility. So if the plant's not functioning, it's not the contractor and designer both pointing at each other and both pointing at the owner saying, well, hey, there's a gap between what we were given as the contractor and the designer says, well, I said you needed to meet these design criteria and you didn't meet them. And the owner's left, in some cases, holding the bag if that goes wrong. And there are fewer contracts.
Mike, if I could, so just to sort of confirm, there's design, bid, build, which is perhaps the most traditional, and then various permutations of design, build. And design, bid, build is where we would contract with a designer who would design the entire project, and then we would take that design, which is a long process, but with lots of city reviews, and then we would take that design and put it out to bid with contractors. Various contractors could then bid on that. And then and the designer would be out of the picture generally at that point, and then it would be the contractor who is doing the building. And so that's the traditional method. Takes a little bit longer, a little bit longer until you have a good idea of the actual construction cost. And Mike has, and we'll continue to look at some of the nuances and some of the pros and cons of those. But the other option, the various permutations of design-build, are we working with one person who represents the design and the building together, and that a little quicker, a little earlier understanding of costs. And so those are sort of the two camps, and then there's some different permutations on design-build, which could add in operate, finance. Is that fair summation?
Yeah, that's good. Okay. We'll do a deep dive on all of this. We'll talk a little bit about the current process, et cetera, but I want to kind of give you an overview of why you can think about doing things different from business as usual. Now, some of the drawbacks of these collaborative delivery methods: construction management at risk, design-build. It requires intensive management. So the owner's got to be all over it, or the owner's representative has to be all over it, because you're seeing less. You're getting less opportunities to review what's going on, so you've got to be in the room with them. There's the potential for higher costs because than the conventional way they're awarded sometimes, because it's qualifications-based consideration for design-build teams. When we go design-build, you pick the lowest qualified bidder. That's state law. So when you go design build, unless you allow opportunities for innovation and allow opportunities for cost to be lower by keeping the selection somewhat open as to what the design builders will ultimately build. Don't get too prescriptive, in other words. You can shift that over so you do get cost savings. But qualifications are very important with selection of the design builder. And it requires prompt reviews and decision making by the owner to realize the savings. If you're going to save money on it, the owner has to be able to respond to issues and questions and things as they come up quickly. Because they're not getting complete plan sets to review at 90%, 95%, you know, 100%, whatever. So they have to be involved and be able to make decisions quickly. Conventional design, so business as usual. Conventional design, bid, build. So you see, we got that same relationship. Contractor, the owner, the designer. Everybody's responsible for the outcome of the project. Everybody's got a role. Three prime players. That's your owner, your contractor, your designer. You have two contracts. Owner to contractor, owner to designer. The owner warrants the designer's work, is what happens to. And that's, there's something we call the spearing doctrine that we'll get into in a minute. That is a court case that made some of those determinations. So the legal constraints with conventional design, bid, build, no legal constraints. You can do that for any project as a public agency. Risk allocation, the owner retains the risk of the design and construction conflicts. So if the design plans are incomplete, then the contractor goes out and does work, then there's a conflict between the owner and the contractor, not between the contractor and the designer, between the owner and the contractor, because that's who holds the contract. Costs, they can be lower if the project's tightly defined by the owner. So you can have lower costs if the project's really detailed design, and you go out for competitive bidding. You know exactly what you want, you know where every pipe needs to sit, every valve needs to go, then you can get lower construction costs. Highest owner control, because the owner's directing the detailed design, but the time is typically the longest because we've got multiple bid periods, we've got NT completing all of their documents, all their plans and specifications. The designer does all that stuff before the project goes out to bid and the contractor gets selected. So that all adds time. So why consider alternative delivery? You'll see the little green highlight there on spearing doctrine. That's where we're coming back into this. There are pitfalls with conventional design, bid, build. Business as usual is not perfect. The spearing doctrine was a 1918 Supreme Court case, and it's held up over all these years. And it really, what it does, it protects the contractor from incomplete or impractical specifications. So what that means is, if the designer draws something that the lines don't meet up at the end of the day, and the contractor can't get it to work, that's the owner's responsibility. It's not the contractor's responsibility to make that work. So that's what it means by owner warrants the sufficiency of the design to the contractor. And the procurement statutes have kind of been slow to realize there might be a better way that exists for some types of projects. I'm not an advocate for alternative delivery for every project. I'm not an advocate of alternative delivery for the whole phase one project. We'll talk about that in a minute. But in some cases, alternative delivery is a good model. So let's talk first about construction management at risk. There are two separate contracts, design and construction. Now in California will not let you do true CM at risk. You have to get special legislation passed. Now, they'll let, I think, education facilities and a few others are allowed to do it, but not the city building a water reclamation facility. So how that would have to occur is there'd be multiple contracts and bids required among all the different specialty contractors to make this scenario work. The contract looks a lot like design, bid, build, because you got a separate contract with the designer, separate contract with your contractor or contractor. But the contractor performs a constructability review early. So normally you can't do that in business as usual or the design bid build process, because then that contractor has an edge if they go bid the job. because they've been involved in constructive building reviews. And so there can be bid protests over that. The other contractors come in and say, well, that's not fair. They got a chance to look at the plans and drive them. And so you can't do that in California. In that case, the CM at risk, CMAR firm, provides a guaranteed maximum price, GMP, and a schedule somewhere over the 60% design. So the designer doesn't get all the way complete, they get about 60 or 70% through it. Then the CM at risk comes in and gives basically a bid, says, hey, here's what we're going to do it for. And then they continue on to the general contractor. So it takes special legislation. So really, there's no legal authority without special legislation or getting multiple bids. Risk allocation, the owner still has the design risk because they still have that contract with the designer separate from the contract with the CM at risk. The costs are going to be lower though, the design bid build, because that contractor's been involved early. And it also helps with the schedule. It goes faster because the contractor had input early. And early input from the contractor is usually a good thing on these projects if it's a good contractor. And then the owner leads the design, but in terms of control, the owner controls it, so the owner leads the design until it's almost complete. So they don't take the design all the way to 100% construction documents, plans and specifications and that sort of thing. But they take it pretty far. They get it to 60 or 70% in some cases. So the difference between these other approaches in design build is, as we said before, design and construction are one contract. There's a single point of responsibility. So that owner has that designer and contractor together in one contract. There's a gap in the design plans. That design builder figures it out. Owner's not responsible for that. So design build is much more accessible to agencies in California than CM at risk. And government code 22160 and a lot of the following codes allow a variety of agencies like Moore Bay, like this project to be built. They have to be projects in excess of one million. And design, build, operate is specifically referenced in the code as something that's not allowed except for a short interim period. And I know we've all seen design, build projects for wastewater plants and water, you know, around the state. But the state, I think it was in January of 2015 that they passed the law specifically says thou shalt not do design, build, operate. Now, you can get special legislation passed if you want to. There's an option with these, but that's a hurdle. The varieties of design, build, they're all numbered. We'll talk about three of them today. First is best value. This is the most common for public works, for the water and wastewater facilities, and most common in California because it was allowed the earliest under the law. Fixed price, best design, kind of like that. If you said, hey, I've got $45 million to build a wastewater plant, and I go out to select design builders, and I want the best design based on each criteria that fit within that $45 million budget, that's fixed price, best design. And then you have a selection process where you judge what it means by best design. And then there's what's called progressive design build. We'll dive into these three main types. Then also, there's with and without operations, with and without financing. So the selection process for any of these is pretty similar. Really, the owner develops their requirements. So what's the owner care about? They can do two levels. They can do what's called performance criteria. And that's where the owner just says, hey, we've got these major requirements. This needs to fit on this site within this envelope. The architecture kind of needs to look like this style, and it needs to be, in your case, these treatment codes. And the design builders go to it. Bridging documents are actually preliminary plans and specifications. So that's when you take the design to, say, a 20 or 30% level where you've got site plan with things laid out in detail. You got the process flow diagrams, and you've gone a little farther down the design decisions, and you release it for the design builder to complete the rest of the design. The request for, so it's in this process, a request for qualifications is usually issued up front. That doesn't require any price or anything from your proposers. The top three teams, the best practice from the Design and Build Institute of America, they recommend final contract after that. So that's the process they recommend in general for design bid. So in terms of that selection process, progressive design bid is based less on price and more on qualifications. We'll talk about how that works in a minute. Best value can be price alone or can be best value, truly. Like you could say, hey, cost is only 40% of the weighting on this selection, or cost is 30% of the weighting. And we care more about things like cool architecture, or we care about other features, water, you know, level of water quality, whether you can do all these other things, energy efficiency, and you can add those on as considerations in your selection process. So you can make all sorts of other things in there besides just cost. So best value can either be cost-based, the cost and other things too. But they're still competing on a cost basis. So best value design build, sometimes it's called a fixed price or a lump sum design build. If it's truly cost-based, not a lot of the other criteria. And the design build team is picked early to have a fixed price and fixed schedule they operate off of. The owner provides the project requirements. It could be what we call those performance criteria, where it's, you know, 20 pages of documents when it comes down to it. Or it could be 30% design, a bunch of plans, a bunch of specifications. The design build firm agrees to design and construct the project under the owner's terms. And then the selection process is based on the price and those qualitative considerations. So in terms of legal constraints, no legal constraints to best value design build. You got to get special legislation passed, you can go do it today. Risk allocation, early transfer of risk to the design build team. Because you got that design builder on board early, they're starting with some very preliminary information provided by the owner. They have the right to rely on anything an owner gives them. So if an owner gave them, let's say, the wrong treatment goal or something, and came back and said, hey, you're not meeting our permit, well, the owner gave them that goal, and that's what they got. So you still have that risk. Anything you provide that contract, that design builder, they still have the right to rely on that. That's part of that Sperian doctrine. Costs, prices set early. Any cost savings accrue to the design build firm often. So if they find a way to get a cheaper way to get from A to B and the owner's okay with it, they get those savings. Now, there are ways you can incentivize that so that the owner can share in that too once you get going. You can do what's called open book accounting, where the owner can actually see the costs and that sort of thing. So there are ways to get better incentive for both the owner and the contractor as you move forward. But typically, it's set up so the cost of savings accrue to the design build firm. And in terms of control, owner has to pick the performance criteria. You got to pick what's most important. You can't totally define everything, so there's no point in being design build. You've given that design builder so much information, they don't have any flexibility anymore. They're relying entirely on what you've given them to build it. So you've taken on a lot of responsibility and don't get the benefit. Now, it's typically faster than construction management at risk and also the design bid bill, DBB, the business as usual, because that design build team is constructing and designing together. They might be out grading the site while the detailed piping design's going on. That's the kind of stuff that can happen. They might procure equipment early before they even got the plant finally laid out. You pick experienced teams so they don't do dumb stuff when they do that. I mean, you go through the quality process and make sure you get somebody that's going to get the wrong piece that will fit. And a lot of these teams have a lot of experience doing this, and they do a very good job of it. Progressive design build, a little different from the best value. It's a multi-step process. You select on qualifications. There has to be a price element to it. But the price element can be things like the design cost, which is a minor amount of the total design, be the design fee. If you can negotiate an overhead percentage or something like that, that would that be the cost part of it. But the selection is mainly qualifications. And so step one is, get that design builder on board, and they take you all the way up. They get up anywhere up to 30 to 60% design, working closely with the owner. So get involved early. And the design build team then provides a guaranteed maximum price proposal after they work with the owner on the design. And in step two, the owner of the design build team negotiate that cost and schedule after that design's been finished by that design builder up to that 30 to 60% cost. And then the project's finished. So the legal constraints, cost always has to be a criteria for selection. You couldn't just go out and say, this is strictly qualifications-based to design and build this wastewater plant. There's no cost consideration. You can't do that. You gotta have some cost. But the law doesn't say what that cost has to be. It could be cost for design, the overhead cost, you could define something. The other transfers risk really early to the design build firm, because they're involved really early on the first stages of that preliminary design. In terms of control, the owner's involved in way more detail in the design process. They're sitting in the room with that progressive design builder, helping make all those decisions early up front. And it typically has the shortest delivery because that design builder is, because of that level of collaboration. So, design, build, operate, that includes the operations and maintenance of the construction facility. And a minimum of 5 years would be typical for that kind of thing. So that's usually how those contracts are set up, is design, build, operate. Sometimes the teams are led by that operations partner. Like some of the operations companies are, and I'll throw just some names out, like Veolia Water, OMI, there are a bunch of these, and they'll lead the design, build efforts, even though they're kind of the operator in a lot of cases, because that operations is a big chunk of the fee and a big chunk of the risk. California law currently requires you to transition to agency operation as quickly as possible. And I'm not sure what the timing is on that, but you know, it can't be 5 to 10 years out. You have to transition to that. But we've all seen projects that have been done in the past, and it could be done with special legislation, despite what's here that around. But there's the time and risk associated with that. So legal constraints are, it's really not allowed in California anymore as of January 2015. It's a new requirement. Special legislation to be required. All the risk goes to that design, build, operate team. Because what you're saying is, you design it, you build it, you operate it to meet the permits, whatever criteria we got. And they got all the responsibility. Typically higher costs, and some folks might debate this, typically higher costs, because if you think about it conceptually, all those entities have to make a profit. Whereas with design, build, no operation, your utility doesn't have to make a profit. All they can do is basically bring in enough money to keep the system running and bring in some reserves. And really that's it. They're not even allowed to make a profit. So, and some agencies opt out because of costs. But the positive is, if you're a very small agency, you see this kind of thing happen a lot. Like small HOA-sized agencies, and little services districts, where they don't have the staff or the expertise to operate something, and they can't really hire them. And they work out arrangements like this because they can they pay more than they would if they had their own staff, but they're not going to be able to necessarily get their own staff because they don't have it. So it just becomes a rate issue. But it's in terms of timing, it's similar to the other design build options. It really doesn't speed up the project to add the operations piece.
Mike, let me expand on the one point about profit. For anybody that is going to come build a wastewater treatment plant or do anything for the city, any business, obviously, is going to need to make some profit. That's why they're in business. So in a design build or a design bid build, whoever we contract with, part of their business is to make a profit for their business. For design build operate, nobody is going to bid to operate our plant for no profit. That said, we have Bruce Keough and the fine team of his fine team that operates our current wastewater treatment plant And we're not operating for a profit. In fact, by law, we can't make any money in that system. So our sewer enterprise fund, our wastewater enterprise fund, we set our rates so that they just meet what the requirement is. So that's, I just want to expand on that a little bit, that that the city has a team, Mr. Keough and his team, that is operating the current plant at a for even, not at a loss. We've fixed that, and not for a profit, and so thus the design build operate. I just wanted to sort of clarify that. Go ahead.
Appreciate that. Thanks. So design build operate finance goes a step further, and that includes the operation and the financing for the project under one team, and that's where an agency or you know, this is a private project, they say, we want an entity to take all the risk, and we're just going to pay them rates. They're going to finance the project. They're going to own. They're going to design the project. They're going to build it. We might own it, but they'll operate it. They'll handle all the financing for us, and they'll take on a lot of the risk. So the city simply pays rates. That's kind of what happens, and they'll own the facility, or may or may not own it in some cases. No additional legal constraints other than the fact you can't do the operation in California without special legislation. But the owner has very low risk. However, it's typically higher cost because those private entities can't get the tax-exempt bonds. They can't get the lower interest financing in most cases that an agency can get much more easily. So you have less control. But in terms of timing, it's similar to the other design build options. So we put together just kind of a preliminary matrix. And again, nobody's making any decisions on this right now. But we kind of wanted to tell you, you know, based on how we see it, here's what we kind of think. So using design bid build as a baseline and just assign zeros to it and having pluses and minuses for everything, in terms of legal constraints, the construction management at risk really has the most legal constraints. Best value design build, you can do that right now. It's no better in terms of legal constraints than design bid build. It's the same in California. The progressive DB, a little bit more legal concern. We had some correspondence back and forth with the city attorney. You know, their concern is that the level of risk the city takes on, and getting a, basically in layman's terms, getting a partnership like that early and counting on working on that cost out with somebody without getting costs up front, and just the concern with that. So risk allocation, really the best value design build has the best risk allocation in a way, because you do your give your performance criteria, you put it out, that design builder takes it and goes with it. Progressive design build, pretty good risk allocation, but the owner's more involved in that upfront design with that design builder closely in the room, and they're all agreeing on that guaranteed maximum price together, as opposed to being a little bit of separation. Costs, you know, the best value design build, progressive, you know, is typically selected because if you do it right, you get a little lower cost than you do with design bid build, often just because of the time savings of money in some cases, helps you some. And the fact that you're allowing some creativity from that design builder, you set up the process right so that they can take advantage of the things they know that will work. In terms of time, the progressive DB can go really fast because you've made so many decisions up front close, but best value design build also goes really fast. And then in terms of the owner control, the owner has really the best control of these on design bid build and CM at risk, because you're producing nearly complete documents under CM at risk. You're producing complete documents with your designer all the way out to under design bid build, the DBB. The best value design build probably has the least under control because you do the performance criteria. When I say least under control, we set that up in a way so that the owner is working closely with the designer. They're not just in a cubicle somewhere. One good method for ensuring good collaboration on design build is to require that the teams co-locate with city staff. similar to what we're doing now, we've got the program office that's being set up behind City Hall. And we've got space in there so that when we have, if the city elected to go design build or elected to follow one of these options, there's space for those folks to actually be in there. And that co-location makes a big deal on design build. And it can feel a whole lot more like a progressive design build if everybody's in the room together. So some considerations for specific to our project. We went through a whole bunch of textbook stuff. But the considerations specific to Ward Bay and are, first, if we look at the phase one wharf, the water reclamation facility itself, we have a greenfield site. Anywhere we're looking, we don't have a whole bunch. We're not doing a retrofit job. So we got a lot of options as to what goes there. One thing we hear repeatedly from the community is the desire for innovation and creative design. And the innovation has two elements to it. One is modern treatment facility, up-to-date, best practice, plus cost savings. Those are the two elements we see of that. And then also the opportunity for creative design, because there's really not much at these facilities now. But there might be a residence near the one that's top ranked in the options report. But we have a few options there. The environmental studies will identify constraints early, so that that alternative delivery entity, whoever they might be, if you go alternative delivery, or anybody that works on this, is going to have a lot of information on site. They'll know the environmental constraints. They'll know if there are any cultural resources there, like any archaeological artifacts that are found. Alternative delivery processes can take all that into account. And the phase one wharf and design and construction is really on the critical path. So that's what's going to take the longest to get a treatment plant up and running in terms of all that phase one work we talked about. So the lift stations and pipelines, I see those, and these are my opinions as program manager, so I'll go ahead and say that. And at the end of the day, council is going to make these decisions after the facility master plan is done. We just want to get this information out early and the thought process out early, because it's the easiest way to get input, is just to clearly say, hey, here's what we're thinking based on where we are right now. The lift station and pipelines, really those aren't critical path for design and construction. They just don't take that long. Ordering the pumps, laying pipe, that stuff doesn't take as long as like the lead time for treatment process equipment, which is a pretty long time. When you look at technologies like membrane bioreactors, sequencing batch reactors, all these sorts of things, there's lead time on all that. That takes a long time. The detailed design plans are really going to be required on this. So wherever the lift stations might go, wherever a lift station might go, and that pipeline route, we got easements and permits we need to negotiate. We also have utility conflicts. Detailed design really has to take place on this, in my opinion. So our recommendations are that the lift station and the pipelines stay a conventional design build. There's not that much opportunity for innovation with the lift station design. There will be architectural considerations. The operators need to be involved in the detailed site planning and all that stuff. That just requires a lot of hands-on detailed design. So our recommendation would be the lift station and pipeline go the conventional business-as-usual design build. But phase one wharf, we see two approaches for consideration. And so this will come back around probably the December, January timeline that we think makes sense. And we're just going to throw them out there now. First one is progressive design build. Now, one of the drawbacks of that is it requires a lot of trust, right? Because most agencies are not that comfortable selecting the contractor / designer with very little cost information in front. So the city would have to commit to preliminary work without a price. You can terminate, though, if issues arise during design. And during the selection process, you're going to look for teams who've done other progressive design builds, and you're going to go talk to the owners they work for and see how they did. Check the references. But there are legal concerns and risks. And we know that this, and I was speak for the city attorney, but as an engineer, I misstate legal stuff all the time, so let's go ahead and do it. But in terms of the The city attorney's concern, there's more legal risk, more risk to the city of litigation in a progressive design build, because establishing the parameters for the selection and then working through the design issues and that sort of thing, not as much track record of that in California, I think is the safest way to put it. A lot more history of success with best value design build. So the second approach for this is the best value design build. So the benefits of that are you define the budget early. You go out with your performance criteria. You can establish if the aesthetic design and a lot of these other features, let's say, percent of energy recovery, alternative energy generation, et cetera, were more important than some other aspects, then you know that selection team involved with this, probably a couple of WRFCAC members, a couple of council members, et cetera, all get in a room together and figure out what makes the most sense for the city. And they decide those are going to be the criteria that are used for the best value. So it doesn't just have to be cost-based, but the early cost is an important upfront element. So you get that, I feel like you get a lot of the benefits both ways with the innovation and also with the early knowledge of cost with this process. So the city has a guaranteed maximum price before the contract's finalized. And there's a good history of success with these in California. So from the legal perspective, there's probably more case law, or that sort of thing, kind of defining what the parameters are. So it's more comfortable from the city's perspective if it's your first foray into design build to probably go that route. So those are my thoughts. So at this point, I've blathered on for quite a while. I'm sure it's been over 20 minutes. But we'd like to open for any questions. We'd like for this to be a dialogue, and I'll try to answer whatever questions we can today. If not, we'll post answers to it if they take a little more time.
So I'll try to sort of moderate this. Linda, please come on up. And as I said, different from the typical council meeting, we look forward this to being a conversation with each person that comes to the podium. So feel free to ask a succinct question. Mike will try to answer that, or whoever is the appropriate person, follow up with another question. At some point, based on timing, we might need to ask that that you cede the podium to the next person so that we can make sure everybody has a chance to engage. But we're here, and that's what we're here for, is to engage. Ms. Merrill.
Hi. Do you have one of those hand mics that we can move around, or you want everybody to come up here, or what's best?
We don't have a hand
okay.
mic, so if you
all right.
go for that, that'd be great.
Good morning. My name is Linda Merrill, and thank you all guys for coming on a weekend and, to do all this for us, and really do appreciate your dedication to this subject. A couple of questions arose for me is why does the, say, good architecture, I'll call it, versus just engineering design, not that engineers aren't clever, but why does that have to be an add-on? I've had a lot of experience in the architectural field, and I'm an artist, and I would like it to look good if possible, even, like not real expensively, but I'd like it to look good if that was a criterion. Something that I have this feeling, and I think everybody in Morro Bay in the room and you all probably feel the same way, is I feel this panic about getting this done. And I know that you all have scheduled a certain number of years to do this, and but I think that as a community, we just feel a panic to get on with this and get it done. Is there some sort of design that of those criterion that you selected or you told us about that would be faster than others? Because, we just feel like we need to. I mean, the drought is the elephant in the room. I was just wondering, was the reason that the design, build, operate, that there was so much, was it legislation that was lifted, or you had to have legislation to do the design, build, operate. Which was it? Do you remember?
Let's start with those three, and I'll take number two. I'll start with that, and then turn over to Mike for the architectural piece and how it looks, and if you or John are the right one to answer the legal piece.
Can I just finish that? Is that because of conflict of interest that they didn't like the design, build, operate idea?
So feel free to stay right there. We'll try to answer, and if we didn't get the answer, then feel free to ask more. I don't sense that there's panic in the city about getting the plant built. There's certainly lots of concern and interest, as there should be, over a project of this magnitude for the city. As Mike stated sort of early on, the council has given us a goal of a 5-year goal for completion at phase one, and that is a fairly aggressive goal for a project of this size, but we are working toward that. So and it's doable. It's fairly aggressive, but it's doable. But that will likely influence the delivery options. And so that's a policy decision that we're following from the council. It has not put us in a panic at this point, but we feel the same. Positive stress that everybody does to get the new plant up and operating as quickly as possible. And I say that there's, you know, stress can be positive, and so that helps, you know, put this where it is on my priority list, on Mike's priority list. This is goal and objective number one, but not a panic, but an appropriate amount of focus and interest to achieve the current goal, which is a policy point that the council has given us to operate within, and which though has an impact on delivery method. And we'll follow up on that in a moment when I get to your other two questions, but at some point we should talk about the likely time differences between design build and design bid build. But Mike, if you'd hit the architectural question.
So in terms of the architecture, I agree that engineers don't do a great job of that. And I'll be the first one to admit that. Now, a couple of opportunities coming up, and it's actually a really good question because Debbie Rudd here is in the audience with RRM, and she's on our team to help with outreach and to lead the next community workshop, which is actually to talk about things like architecture. You know, what are the opportunities? The nice thing about all these is if you look at other projects that have gone these alternative routes like design build, for example, a lot of them have been really nice buildings. Like universities have used it for kind of landmark facilities that are really innovative, really neat. So there's plenty of opportunities for that. It all depends on how you set up that selection process and what you ask them to do. Because those teams will get the most innovative architect on their team that meets your objectives if that's what you want. And so you can define what looks good and what makes sense for the site within those performance criteria.
I'll say from the city's perspective, we are already working with at least the property owner at the number one site, Rancho Colina, and want to get the McIlvain family part of this discussion, and they are, on what it looks like. So this is not anything close to a decision. It's not even necessarily what's been discussed. But could it have a coastal ranch theme? With Cal Poly test avocado groves surrounding it, so that it, as you drive down the drive down 41, that it looks that it fits right into place. Absolutely, it could and should. There's a cost for how gorgeous that looks. But what I sense so far is that the city, the public, and the property owner are all interested in having something that doesn't look like a big ugly eyesore.
So a couple of other things I'll respond to, too, is, yeah, I'm not sure what the origin is of eliminating the operations from that state law. The state law basically says you can't have, you cannot operate the facilities if you're the design builder, other than like an interim period. What they'll allow is a little period to start to help work out the kinks or help with startup of the facility. Because when you build a new wastewater plant, it can take you 3 months or 6 months just to get all of your chemical feed systems figured out. And get all the operational stuff really dialed in. So they'll allow some of that. I'm not sure what the origin of that is. That's a good question. We were talking about that this morning. I don't know what drove that. But it's very specific.
I heard Linda's question was it legislation that says you can't do that?
Yes.
Okay, so it was positive legislation that say you can no longer do that, which means for us to be able to do that, we would have to get special legislation allowing the city of Morro Bay to do that.
And that was done when you say, well, why would we even look at that? Well, that was done with a lot of early design build projects and a lot of alternative delivery projects that have been done in California. Some of those require special legislation. That's how some of that stuff was actually done, some of the older ones. But it adds time and it adds a challenge. The other comment on the on schedule. So the thing I would say is, you know, the two options that we selected what we're recommending, the progressive design build and the best value design build, we feel like we both expedite the schedule quite a bit. And we feel like the only way you get to a five-year schedule, realistically, is doing those. And I think your comment on feeling a sense of panic is a good one. The way I've looked at it, too, what's kind of been expressed to us from council is, if we hit a point in this where we're just hitting a five-year schedule to hit a five-year schedule, they want to know. They want us to give them their feedback, say, hey, you know what? We need 6 months longer because this thing came up. So council's been very open about that. That 5-year goal is important, and we're driving towards it, and it's a goal. But if we hit a point where we say, you know what, something came up and this just doesn't make sense, or we need to wait 6 months because there's some special legislation repassed or something, then we need to bring that to council as quickly as we can and let them consider it. But for now, the driver is the schedule.
Okay. One of the drivers.
Mike, can you address while the next person is coming up either in percentage terms or in years? Let's say that we could do a design build permutation in 5 years. If it was a design bid build, how many years might that be?
So there was a study, and I don't recall the university right now. So I hate to say take my word for it, but I'll tell you. There was a study that was done probably 15 or 20 years ago on alternative delivery, in particular design build. And what they concluded was design build resulted in a 33% time savings on projects. I will dig that up. I will find that reference, and we'll either add that to the end of the PowerPoint or we'll post it somewhere. But there's a study that was done. It's pretty old now. There's actually an update of that study coming, but I don't remember which two universities, but I'll get that out.
So roughly that means that if we are able to complete phase one in 5 years under a design build, then it would be more like 6.5 years to complete phase one with a design bid build.
Could be. And all projects are different, and that study was probably looking more at buildings and that sort of thing, because that's really where a lot of the design build work started, was more vertical infrastructure.
Good morning, Bill Martini.
Morning.
On just that comment alone, I know when we visited Santa Paula, the PERC plant, they mentioned that they had off-the-shelf technology that they delivered, I believe, in 18 months. So if you're talking time frames, yeah, it was an 18-month delivery period from when they got the go to when the project was completed. The other thing, talking on cost, I think a lot of your cost on the treatment plant is afterwards on the operational. And getting back to the PERC plant, their operation was a two-man operation. They could operate it on an iPad. And so I'm not sure what the current plant, and where I'm driving on this is a private company can a lot of times deliver a plant as opposed to government with a lot of their rules and regulations. So when you get a design bid, and I know operate is not on the table now, but finance, when you say they have to make a profit, they can, when you're competing with a government agency and government specs, that's when, in my estimation, private corporations can actually make their profit by delivering a product for sometimes half the amount. It's kind of like the $300 toilet seat, or like we did $1 million ice machine that, you know, private companies could do for 150 grand. So profit margin, that. And then secondly, as far as operational, when the cost of operation is huge, because that's out 20 years, and when you have two employees running a plant as opposed to, what, eight employees, I'm not trying to get rid of employees, but just from an operational cost, that's where the majority of your long-term cost on operating. I think Morro Bay, what is it, $850,000 a year or something like that? I can't remember the exact figures, but somewhere in that range.
Are you talking personnel?
Or, yes.
Yeah, it would probably be close to that.
That's what I'm saying, as opposed to two employees. So, I mean, there's savings, and the question that I had was, I understand the builder cannot operate the plant now, or they have to get a special waiver for it, but can that be still farmed out to a private company or corporation as opposed to the builder? So, I mean, that's...
Yes.
That's what I was thinking. So it just can't be one and the same.
That's correct.
And they can, in turn, they can spin off to a LLC under their, I mean, in other words, there a lot of companies form a separate company to bypass regulations, I should say.
It's great. Let me just address two of those things, Bill, and then we can keep the conversation going.
Correct.
So one of the reasons we have the number of people operating the current plant we do is it's an old technology 62-year-old plant.
Correct.
So assuming that we have a more innovative, newer technology plant, if PERC or Acme Corp can operate it with two people, so would we be able to.
Correct.
And yes, we certainly have the option, as we do with many areas of city services, to contract that that service out. And that's something that that I look at all the time, is what's the best way to deliver this service for our community. And as we go through this with the wastewater treatment plant, we would ask that question as well.
Correct. And that was my kind of my, I appreciate the feedback, because that was the feedback when, you know, years ago we did visit Santa Paula. The Coastal Commission was there at the time, and they said, this is the type of plant, this is the type of innovation we want to see. And, of course, you are still in the coastal zone, you know, even out on Steve's property. So if they're going to be kind of the ultimate 800-pound gorilla making the decisions, that technology is kind of on the radar. So just to put that out there.
If I can just make one comment about the Santa Paula plant.
Correct.
And financing. So
sure.
You may have seen in the news recently that the city of Santa Paula just repurchased the wastewater treatment plant from the city of Santa, or from PERC Water.
Correct.
For a number of reasons, but one of the reasons was, if I recall, the financing that they had with PERC was in the 6.5% to 7.5% range, and they were able to get financing from the state in the 1% to 3% range. So, we've talked about financing a little bit. It is almost certain. We need to look at all this, but it's almost certain that a state revolving fund loan would be the best financing rate we as a city could get for the project, either from any source, private source, or from the state.
That's correct. I know at the time, 6.5%, I think state funds at that time were more like 4, 4.5. So they still had a spread where they had a little higher spread, naturally being private money, and the spread would still maybe be a couple percent difference. So, yeah, I understood that, yeah, now the interest rates have dropped, like home refinancing, everyone's refinancing like crazy because of the bargain interest rates, and Santa Paula did that, correct. The other thing I was bringing up was, as far as the property itself that you're looking at, that's zoned ag, and typically in the coastal zone, ag is... I believe that property is anywhere from 40 to 160 acre minimums. Usually that dry grazing is 160 to 320. Is a city allowed to subdivide? This is in the coastal zone, and coastal will have the say-so when you're asking for a 10-acre parcel or a 20-acre parcel. Would this be more a lease situation, or are you going to actually be able to purchase? Because typically ag zoning will not allow that type of subdivision, and is there some special circumstances where the city can subdivide where a private individual can't? Just another potential fly in the ointment if you bump against that, because coastal won't go for it typically. So that's kind of a side.
Let me have either John or Mike just address the subdivision piece, and then I'll talk about the purchase price piece.
Generally, cities have much more flexibility with regard to creating and subdividing parcels under the Subdivision Map Act. As to any restrictions the Coastal Commission would place, we'd have to look at that and discuss that with them to ensure that they'd be okay with the plans the city have with regard to the size of the property the city wants to acquire.
Right.
Yeah, I'll also note that Coastal has already indicated that they think that the Rancho Colina site is a very good site.
Correct.
So our preferred site, Coastal, has sort of given an initial blessing on that. And because there is appropriate and legitimate concern about the fiscal part of this, the city cannot pay more than the fair appraised value for the land. So the process, it would be a purchase. Mm-hmm. We would not lease the land. The city would purchase the land. And the purchase price essentially would be determined by the appraisal. I believe the law allows the city to pay no more than 10% more than the appraised price for the property. But there is a limit on the purchase price to whatever the fair appraised value is.
Correct. I think that site's an excellent site. It was just I didn't know if a fly in the ointment would be the zoning and, you know, whether the city has more leeway, because I know a private individual can't do that. And in the coastal zone, if you could actually purchase that, do the subdivision. So that was just an added concern. And then, lastly was I do know that it would appear that with private individuals possibly being able to compete price-wise better than the government agencies, that if you actually had a design, you know, build, finance, or possibly not finance, that you might be able to get something off the ground quicker. I know each option has one's pricier, one's faster, one's, you know, better innovation, so you have to kind of balance all three of these balls. But as far as quality and end product, a lot of times I find that if you do it all at once rather than in phases, it's sometimes cheaper and faster as opposed to phasing it out in two phases. A lot of times the second phase sometimes doesn't happen or gets pushed out 10 years as opposed to 2 years or so. And in the end, it's just my impression, if you kind of put the whole ball of wax together at one time, it tends to happen and happens cheaper. Thanks.
Just we're changing changing speakers.
Absolutely.
I'll just make one final.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Oh no, I thought you were.
I was just going to make one final comment on. We agree that having a professional private entity do construction is certainly a better option than having the city do the construction.
Right.
So under no circumstances are we going to expand the Public Works Department and have them build the plant. We're gonna have a private entity do it as efficiently as they can.
And my name is Steve McElvain. I wanted to make a quick comment to what Bill has just asked. He's correct. If you're dealing with agricultural zoning in the coastal zone, it is a major concern for the commission. The particular property that the city is looking at right now is zoned recreation. So we've overcome probably a major stumbling block with the commission. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Stoll.
Thank you. Chuck Stoll, please. Thank you. Actually, I was hoping that our landowner would answer the question that came up at the last council meeting, and that is, what's the status of our purchase of this land and the use? That's one of my questions.
Great. Let me take a stab at that, and if Mr. Okay. McElvain would like to come back, but we've been communicating quite well. So for Good. Those of you that watched or at the council meeting, obviously a concern. The city has had three very productive meetings with Mr. McElvain and his family in the last 3 days. So we are continuing to work closely with not only with Mr. McElvain, but with his wife and children. As recently as yesterday afternoon, Debbie Rudd and John Rickenbach and Mike Nunley sat with the McElvains in their kitchen, I believe it was. And so we are working closely with the property owner of the preferred site, but we need to come to a complete agreement both on the details of an MOU and the specific acreage, which specific site would be acceptable to the McElvains and to the city. Also, part of that is the whole architectural idea and how beautiful we could make this look to mitigate some concerns on all parts. So we're working closely with the McElvains. We hope to reach a consensus, and that is our goal.
And I'm in complete agreement. Steve McElvain again. As long as they haven't kicked me out of their consideration, I'm certainly willing to continue to work with it. The concern suddenly came up when the city, probably trying to figure out what they could do with all of the property, suddenly went on both sides of Highway 41. And I don't think the citizens of Morro Bay would necessarily want to use Reno's sign over the freeway coming into town with a lot of development on both sides. But I think as far as having the water reclamation facility or treatment facilities out in the process, and the reason I'm here is to hear from the public too, we're looking at structures and can you do it in such a way that if people driving down the road think they're still in the rural part of the community and really don't even notice the doggone things there. And I think that's the goal both of the city council, myself, and everybody else. So I'm still in the running, I believe, unless they say I can't do it anymore. And I'm here to learn from everybody else. One of the reasons I've come to all the meetings that I can is there's little tidbits. I may sit through an hour of meeting, and there's a piece of information that I didn't know before, and it's great that these things are broadcast, too, so that everybody has that opportunity. So, yes, I'm still in the running. We're still going to try to do something for this community, and I look forward to working with the city to achieve that. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. You know, I've been here not that long, 10, 12 years, and I've noticed that we're quite notorious for not actually agreeing on things. We've had several elections. We've even attempted to recall our mayor. So I'm sure there's going to be people who are going to have a million questions about what we're going to do here. We had a tough time getting our parklet passed. So my concern is it's not nearly as much about panic as it about anxiety. We have a lot of people, including myself, that certainly would like to get this thing going and do it right, of course. But it seems to me like we have, according to Mr. Nunley, a couple, the progressive design build and the best value design, that might be where we're going to have to choose. And we elected a city council that then hired you, Mike, and we've put a lot of faith in your ability and your expertise. So I don't know how long this process can take. I assume it could take a lot longer than 5 years, and I'm hoping that's not true, because I think the general public really would like to get this thing going and make a decision. So that's the anxiety end of it. And again, I know the ultimate decision is the council, but I think they're going to rely highly on you, Mike, to do this. So What is your thought about these two? I mean, you gave us two options here. What do you think? Maybe it's too early.
Well, can I let me start and then turn over to Mike for those options if I could. So, in May, the council gave us very clear direction to start work quickly, i.e. to declare Rancho Colina as the preferred site. That actually occurred back in December. And then there was the Cayucas issue, and right after that, that was the 29th or 30th of April, at the next council meeting, the city council said we are going to build a Morro Bay owned and operated plant and start working it. Since that point, we have essentially completed the fatal flaws analysis, which has said that the Rancho Colina site has no fatal flaws. And that was sort of a check to make sure that we weren't going to spend money at a site that wasn't suitable. We have hired a program management team. We have hired a facility management or the facility master planning team, Black and Veatch, and we have approval to hire the environmental consultant. And so we are on timeline for that 5 years. And I'm going to turn over to Mike for the second half of your question, which is
And I think that's valuable information for people to know what kind of progress we've made, because they've been hearing this, you know, for a few years.
Right.
Sure. So what I would say is I view the progressive and the best value as both being good options. One thing that we're going to see over the next 4 months is we're going to complete the facility master plan. We'll get input from the public on architecture and stuff like that. That might kick you one way or the other. It all depends on what else happens at the particular site. You know, if there's a little education center component or other things that might come up, it might push us one way or the other, because you may want to have a different level of control through a different point of design. I would say for most agencies, in terms of comfort level, most agencies are going to have more of a comfort level with best value design. Just because you get your cost up front, you can get creative concepts and all that sort of thing as part of the evaluation process. That's what I've seen. But that doesn't mean that's how Morro Bay has to go. The way I see my role as program manager is I'm gonna do the analysis, crunch the numbers on a lot of these different issues that will come up. Mm-hmm. And what I want to do is present, you know, a couple of recommendations, a couple of top-ranked options to council, to WRFCAC for their input, and then let council decide. Answer every question they got. If they say, Mike, what would you recommend? I'll say it at that point.
Okay.
But I would say for where we're at right now, let's get through some community workshops and see what else we want at the site, how we want it to look. Let's get the property nailed in. Property negotiation, as you all saw the other night, is can take a while. It takes a little back and forth. So let's get all that stuff kind of buttoned out first in the next 4 months. I want to push this out early, because I think for the range of options and the range of things we're discussing, progressive and best value will both cover them real well. On the lift station in Force Main, I have a very definite opinion and definite recommendation on that.
Good.
Based on my experience with these projects, I think that should go conventional design bid build, because there's no innovation incentive with that. There's no schedule incentive. You have to work with Caltrans on the permit. You've got to design the pipeline all the way up, because you're in 41 right away. And I don't see any advantage to going. So my recommendation is we keep that one separate design, separate construction.
Well,
usual.
I'm sure hoping that today's turnout is not indicative of our community involvement. I don't think it is. I'm hoping that they're all going to watch TV and get involved in this, because this is a huge issue, but it can be prolonged, as you're well aware. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chuck.
Your time.
Thank you. Ms. Winholtz, good morning.
Betty Winholtz. I have three particular topics. One, I want to reinforce what other people have said. If you don't want to call it panic, then we'll call it anxiety. But this has been going on forever, and it just needs to be done. And we don't see a lot of progress. So that 5 years, I hope, is a real solid deadline. Second, in light of the kinds of things that announced at City Council on Tuesday about what kinds of things you want to put out on the property besides the wastewater treatment plant, is that $100 million price tag include all those things? Or is that an additional cost to us public people who are paying for this? You know, is that part of that, or is it just the plant itself?
The only item that is not one of the council's goals for the plant that is being considered is the courtyard. So one of the goals includes energy, and so a solar component or other energy capturing component is part of the cost of the plant. The courtyard is, we need to think our way through that on, but we want to, we need to be sure that we are not funding a courtyard with water or sewer dollars, because that's illegal.
Exactly. But there was like four different things mentioned. So, you know, you had the sewer plant, you have the solar, you've got the corporate yard, there was something else involved. And so, because our price tag of, you know, 30 million something dollars 5 years ago has jumped to 100 million, which doesn't make sense for us being the public. And so if you're adding all these other goodies on, maybe that's part of why the cost has jumped. That's just my comment. Didn't need feedback. And then the third thing is, and I've mentioned this before, this is a very boring, dry topic. You know, what we want to talk about is what is that plant going to do? What's the job description or the project description? And you guys have refused to deal with that. You've said all this other thing comes first, the schedule comes first. But even in your report Tuesday night, when you were hiring when the council hired the environmental group, it even says in there, we can't do anything until there's a project description. And so what is going on? And why can't we get that project description? Because for me, it seems to me there are businesses out there that will blend and do different things with depending on what the project description is. They'll come in with these different little design things or different bids or different, all that kind of conglomeration. And so I need some help with that.
Mike, will you talk about the project description and the facility master plan?
So the facility master plan started middle of July. We have our first presentation to WRFCAC on Tuesday by Black Beach. We're going to have a discussion middle of November, a presentation on liquid treatment technologies. The next three WRFCAC meetings are going to be discussing pieces of the facility master plan. So you're going to start to see those things rolling out over the next couple of months through January. January is really when the facility master plan is done. We've got a definite project description on what the facility is going to do. When we brought ESA on board, there's upfront work they can be doing before that. What goes in the box is figured out with the plan. So
the project.
But what goes in the box, we don't know if that's going to be underground, on top of the ground, you know, over 5 acres, 2 acres. So I don't think you've addressed that yet. I mean, that's why I don't get how you're doing all this other stuff before you get that design of the project done or the job description. So how does that work?
So there are a bunch of efforts going in parallel. First is one of the things they've done is they've put together the flows and loadings memo to figure out what flow and load we're dealing with. The middle of November is really, that's when they're going to have the liquid treatment process stuff kind of figured out for presentation to the public. I actually think it's a pretty good timeline. They started in July. And so August, September, October, November, 4 months later, we're going to be able to start treatment process discussions. So
those are discussions with the WRFCAC, and the WRFCAC will be providing input.
Yeah, well, middle of November is actually a community workshop or community technical presentation on treatment process. And they're going to bring in a few alternatives for the public to review and respond to questions and that sort of thing. So I think it's moving pretty quickly.
So then my last comment then would be, this kind of turnout is because I don't see how you've advertised. Okay? I don't know. I've not gotten in my mail. Nobody reads the newspaper anymore. You know, you have to have signed up for something on the city website in order to get anything back. So I don't know how you're letting the public know that this is here, that this is important, that there's a WRFCAC, that whatever it is that they do, and that they're welcome to come to that. So to get it out of the technical language and down to common language, and then to let us know about that, thanks.
Yeah. Hi, David Nelson, and I live here in Morro Bay. Let me stand behind what Betty said here. I think you need to hear that because this workshop is fine, but to be honest, we've heard this before, but I'm glad that you're bringing it forward and people can look at it on TV and people that haven't heard it before can hear it. But I would feel more comfortable, as Ms. Winsholl said, that we know what we're going to build, basically, and then we know that you guys are going to do the job. I mean, to rebuild trust in this community is going to take communications. We need to believe that you hear what we're saying, and what we're saying is we want the best. I mean, if you're going to charge us $100 million, we should get the best. And if we don't get the best, we're paying you guys way too much money to watch out for us. So, you know, if you, you know, I'm not an engineer. I don't know what's available out there, but I would certainly feel better if I knew that people in our community was helping with the research, because I know that our community can accomplish anything. We have more talented people here than you even realize, and not to utilize the community cuts the community out, and we're standing here not trusting you guys because you're not even listening to us. So, you know, coming back, and I appreciate you started from July, but I was at a podium like this 6-7 years ago, and we're still at the same place, except we're lots of money in the hole. So, you know, if you're going to have our trust, and I'm willing to give you my trust, I talked to a couple of you before the meeting, and I know that we need this. I called for ditching our outfall permit a long time ago because it wasn't right to be dumping 1 million gallons of sewage into the ocean. So here we are, 10, 12 years later, we still dumping water into the ocean, and I don't think much closer than we were 2 years ago. So get our trust, give us something good, might not be the perk plant, but bring us something new. I mean, and let's make sure the community understands what we're going to get, and we'll be totally behind this. I mean, people have been behind this 10, 15 years ago saying to build a new plant. So let's build the trust and get out there, but you're not going to do it by having, you know, 15 or 20 people in the audience. Hopefully AGP will reach a lot more. But, you know, I think once you come forward and say, this is what we're going to have, the community can go back to our business and let you guys do what you do. But until then, you're going to have a lot of scrutiny and a lot of people that are going to give you a lot of static because of past actions. So we got to get past the past into the future, and, you know, design build seems to be the only logical alternative. I mean, it's great to see all the other ones, but I can trust that's the best one because it just makes sense. So, you know, to have me here for a couple hours on Saturday is kind of inconvenient, but I'll do it. But, you know, let's get the important things out there so we see the big picture, and then the little minutiae works its way out, because if you have a good project on a table and people can see it's a good project, everybody in this room can recognize a good project. I guarantee that. So just bring it to us and, you know, have our committee, our citizens committee, more involved so that we can talk to those people that we know it's going on right. I mean, hiring people's easy. Everybody's willing to take a paycheck, but we want results and we want something really good that we as a city can be proud of. Thanks.
I do want to make one response, too. I think, you know, WorkAct really has been really important for us. And there hasn't been a lot we've been able to roll out so far, but over the next 2 months, you know, they're going to be having bi-weekly meetings. And what they're going to be doing is reviewing interim deliverables from the facility master plan team, providing comments. And so it's going to be really important as a part of the process. Maybe really important so far, too.
I really appreciate your comments, and I haven't been here for certainly close to the number of years of all of you, but I understand the frustration over standing at this podium 8 years ago and thinking that there was going to be something delivered, and now 8 years later, it looks like nothing's happening. I would just say that I'm excited at how much is happening right now, and granted, it's sort of behind the scenes, but the fact that the council approved the fatal flaws analysis and those are complete, that the council hired a facility master planner and they are almost halfway through their process, and the facility master plan will result in a project description. And then the fact that they hired a program management team, we are clearly now on the march toward a plant, a water reclamation facility at the preferred site, or I should say with a preferred site. We are moving down that track. Much of that's behind the scenes right now, and that's what we're doing today is bringing, is trying to show everybody what's happening behind the scenes so that it can come to the scenes. Ms. Bass, excuse me.
Nancy Bast. All those speakers that spoke before me, they were reading my mind. I have three particular things I want to talk about. Recycled water at startup. We have to have recycled water at startup. This is what the community wanted 10 years ago when this whole thing started. If the state is working on something that will say toilet to faucet, it'll happen within 3 years. It'll happen within the time that this project will be completed. So we should work towards that. If it doesn't, we can put it into a recharge basin. We can add it to our groundwater. But we have to do that. And the cost will only go up for phase two. So let's do what we originally wanted in this community and get recycled water from the beginning. Second is, please, no ox ditch smell. No ox ditch smell. Supposedly the digesters take care of that smell, I've been told, but it doesn't. We've had our digesters reconditioned recently, and when I go to Miners, half the time I smell that. If I go to Silver City to visit somebody, it reeks. If you go to San Luis Obispo and try to do that lovely trail along the creek, it's next to the sewer plant, you can't even stand it. So let's talk about smell, too. And those people that have invested their money in Rancho Colina Homes and Mr. McElvain, they don't deserve to have a smell, ever. And the third, we got to make sure that it's the newest technology imaginable. MBR membrane reactor system is a small footprint. It's enclosed, as far as I'm concerned. It's what we need. So, please, let's do those things. You'll make the whole community happy.
Thanks. Sure. Mike, do you want to...
Is this casual enough?
Yes, yes, it absolutely is. Do you want to address any of those things? Or?
No, I'm just taking notes and kind of hearing what people are saying.
Great.
You know, our goal with recycled water, too, is we want to move as quickly on that as possible. There's no incentive.
Yeah. That's good to hear. No, I just wanted to dispel the myth that good architecture or good engineering has to cost more. I'm glad the RRM woman is here, and I think she'd agree with me that it doesn't have to cost more to look good. I just wanted to dispel that myth, and I could give you a little history of architecture and good versus bad and cost versus blah, blah, but you probably all know what I'm trying to say, but it doesn't have to cost more to look good, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to dispel that myth. Thank you.
Sorry, Linda, I was looking funny because we want to have a great conversation here. So I think I would agree that it doesn't have to cost a lot more. But let me just say it this way. If we wanted to have no trees at all and vegetation used to mask, block, and make the site look good, let me put it this way. Having some trees and having some vegetation to make it look a little nicer does cost a little bit more, but it's certainly well worth it. And so I think what I heard is a nice design doesn't have to cost exponentially more, and this city wants that. Is that fair enough? Great, thanks.
Almost noontime. Bill Martini again. Yeah, actually, I was going to comment on that very same subject, and tree lines have historically worked phenomenal on view blocking and that, and the one thing, I mean, and avocados and that don't cost a thing because they support themselves, so that's a non-issue. In fact, they produce money as opposed to costing. The one thing on a tree line, if we're talking a five-year timeline, cypress trees, you stick them in the ground today or next week. You don't wait for 5 years, and you have your view blocking now. And so, and if 5 years from now it doesn't work, you choose another site. You can either leave them in place or they can be removed. So that's something that you'd want to jump on yesterday, and just a kind of an added thought. Bye.
It's a great idea. Anybody else? This is a great conversation. We're happy to keep it going. We're going to be back in here at 2:30, from 2:30 to 4:30, and hopefully with another great group of folks who are interested. Debbie, please. It will be on Monday morning.
On our city
website on the Hot Topic under WRF, Water Reclamation Facility.
You
bet.
Hi, Debbie Rudd with RM Design Group. I'm part of the team. I just wanted to mention again that we will be talking about architecture at the next community workshop that's more community focused, less technical focused. That's hasn't been advertised yet, and we're going to start doing that next week. And that's tentatively scheduled now for Thursday, October 29th at 6:30. So Thursday, October 29th at 6:30. And we want to do some exercises, some interactive exercises to look at what you want it to look like, and hope everybody can come on down to that.
I saw some concern with that date. Is that too soon?
It's a Thursday. It's after dark. It's getting dark earlier. How do you get the old people out? How are you going to notice them?
So maybe I can come talk to you after this. We also heard concerns about having workshops on Saturdays because we can't get the young families out because their sports activities are all day Saturdays, and people said, don't take my Saturday. So we're trying to just spread the workshops around. We want to have some during the week and the evening. We want to have some on Saturday, and we want to try to meet everybody's needs. But we also want to have reach out in other ways just than workshops so that people who can't make these workshops can also come. Another thing that we want to do is we have the workshop, we have the website now that is on the city website, but we are embarking on and enlarging that website so that we can have PowerPoints here, we can have workshop information. So we're not just relying on public workshops, but we're going to have a lot of different methods to gather feedback and get people's input and then also inform people.
And we're open to any suggestion folks have. Scheduling, we really want to try to get as much out as we can to folks. And like you'll see even today, we get into some things that aren't specifically on the topic. That's fine. We'll answer whatever questions we can. And hopefully among all these workshops, we try to catch everybody we can. Much advice you put you have on noticing would be helpful when scheduling meetings.
Chuck, did you have a question or comment? I thought I saw a hand start to go up a moment ago. No?
No.
Okay. Would you like to make one?
No, you've done a great job today. I'm very happy.
Great. Okay, any final comments? Good. Look at that. It is exactly noon. We didn't really plan it that way, but perfect. Thank you so much for being here. We'll be back here at 2:30.